Hi, my name is Misha Berlinski, and my new book is Mona Acts Out.
In his new novel, Mona Acts Out, Misha Berlinski explores the world of Shakespearean actors in New York City during a period both before and after the Me Too movement. The present story takes place on one Thanksgiving day, while the past story floats in through conversation and rumination, offering different worldviews on a particular time and place. I recently spoke with Misha Berlinski about his love of Shakespeare and how the Me Too movement affected the characters in his novel. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Misha Berlinski. Can you set the book up for us? When we begin Mona Acts Out, it's Thanksgiving in New York City, right?
Yeah, we're in the bedroom of an actress. Her name is Mona Zahid. She's lying in bed. She's got bright sunshine coming in through the window, which really pisses her off because she pulled the shades down at night and her husband, in a totally passive aggressive move, opened them up. She hasn't got enough sleep because she did a show last night and she's tired. And she can hear her in-laws on the other side of the door already starting to squabble and look for her father-in-law's glasses. That's where the novel starts. So this actress, she's 40 something and she's got a lot of problems in her life. And this is the day they're all going to come to a head. And that's where the novel starts, with her in bed, wishing she were anywhere else.
So let's talk about Shakespeare. In your acknowledgments, you wrote that John Barton's series titled Playing Shakespeare, which is available on YouTube, is where this novel began. Talk to me about that.
I just loved that series. I found it about 2014. It's a series that John Barton was one of the founders of the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company. And about 1981 or 1982, he did a series for PBS with a lot of the stars of his theater company in England, who became world stars afterwards, like Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, Judi Dench, Ben Kingsley. All of them were really young. They were really ambitious actors. And he just did a whole series about playing Shakespeare and how you play Shakespeare, according to him. And so he'd have them do a scene or a monologue, and then he'd give his thoughts about how it could be done better. And they'd do it again, and you could see them improving in front of their eyes. And then they'd talk about the scene and what it means and about the characters. And this is really the first time I ever loved Shakespeare. I mean, I'd taken Shakespeare classes in college and learned a lot about Shakespeare, but really didn't have much affection for him. But just seeing these people and how much they loved Shakespeare and how he was just, they were playing these roles as if they were written yesterday, trying to understand them. All of it just came alive to me. And I was like, oh my God, I get it. I love Shakespeare. He's as good as everyone says. He's just so funny when he's funny and so smart when he's smart and so sad when he's sad and so moving. I watched all 9 episodes and went back to the beginning and watched them again. And then I probably have watched them 4 or 5 times since. And if your readers want to do themselves a favor, after they buy my book, they should watch all 9 episodes of Playing Shakespeare. It is great. And it's free and it's on YouTube. And the way it's done, it's so lively. It's so intimate because he just has them do a scene and then they're all sitting around in their street clothes, all these superstars who are incredibly young and so beautiful. And then they just talk about how to do it better. It really opened my eyes up, not just to Shakespeare, but how actors at work and how a lot of art is made. I can't say how much that series meant to me.
I have a follow-up about that later, but I think first we should probably meet some of the other characters. One of the people we meet initially through Mona's ruminations is Milton Cast, who once ran the fictional Disordered Rabble. Milton is a divisive figure, and I noted many lines throughout the book, but one of my favorites was, sometimes the debate over Milton took place in the space of a single soul. What can you tell us about him?
He's a dominant man. He's a man who made himself, in my telling of his story, and there's many tellings of his story, I think. He was the son of he inherited a Greek diner, didn't want to run a Greek diner for a living. He made himself out of nothing in the 1960s into one of the leading cultural lights of New York. He was a man who was extremely sensitive in the sense that he could listen to people, talk to them, feel what they were feeling and empathize with them, but it was always in the service of some goal. So he would do it to get a better performance out of his actors. He was uncanny in his ability to hit the spots, the emotional sweet spots of almost everyone, in the ability to get these incredible performances out of his actors. But he could also do it because he was a womanizer. And he certainly was somebody who, if he was in your life, he was one of the dominant figures in your life, and not always in a positive way, but not always in a negative way either. He was just a huge man. That's the way I saw him, at least.
Yeah, and I want to avoid spoilers, but, you know, to go a little bit further with that, can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Mona and Milton?
Well, Mona came into the company as a young actress, and she was very much Milton's protege. She was younger than him by about 30 years. She was quite dependent on him in the sense that her career really depended on him. But not just that, but she felt like she became a richer, better actress under his tutelage. They had an affair at one point. I don't think that's a huge spoiler to give away. But Mona lived for his approval. That was the most important thing in her life for many, many years. And when he finally left the company, which is where the novel is beginning, 1 year after that, she misses him very, very much. He was an important figure in her life, but she's not entirely certain what the nature of that relationship was, whether it was something positive or negative. And a hard part of this book is her just thinking about what did that relationship mean?
You are incredibly knowledgeable about Shakespeare. That's evident through reading this book. In fact, as we mentioned, we're not just reading about Shakespeare's plays, but playing the roles in the plays. Through memory, we learn a lot about all of the roles Mona has played, and, you know, including her upcoming performance as Cleopatra. You allow your characters to offer insights into acting. And at one point, Milton had said, "It's such a privilege to spend our days with these people." And the people in question were Shakespeare's people, who were entirely real in Milton's mind.
The quote about Shakespeare, "It's such a privilege to spend our days with those people," I can't claim that I invented it. I do acknowledge in the acknowledgments that I took that from another director. I think that it was Glenn Byam Shaw who wrote that wonderful little part that I gave to Milton. And he talked about what a privilege it was to spend our days with these people. We catch them in a moment in their life where they're living more intensely than you and I have ever lived. And they speak so beautifully and they feel so much more than we feel. I thought that just captured so nicely what it was like for these actors to play Shakespeare and what the addiction of playing Shakespeare must be for these actors. That these characters, when you have a career playing Shakespeare, they live every kind of life. They live every kind of emotion putting on these plays. That's where I got that quote. That's why I thought it was such a, why it was worth putting into the book, even though it wasn't my words.
And to go on that emotion, another line I noted was from Mona. She wondered when exactly all the emotions but grief, anger, and gratitude had become play acting. Those were the three emotions you were allowed after a certain age. Exhilarated was off the table.
Well, I don't know if that's actually true. I think Mona felt it at that moment. But I do think that it's some part of aging is that certain youthful emotions are diminished in their intensity and other emotions are replaced them, at least in my case. And I think that it might be true of others. I mean, we tend to feel a whole lot more gratitude as we age for what we have. We recognize that those things are not necessarily given to us or given to others. The exhilaration, it comes often with the first time we feel an emotion or see a certain sensation, and that can diminish with age as well. Emotional life changes with time. It's not always a constant. There's certainly a lot more grief as you age because you see things that you loved disappear and are lost. That's not a part of youth. I felt like Mona was coming to terms a little bit with that in this book, that, and her character. I mean, Cleopatra also is coming to terms with these things in this book, or in that play.
One of the reasons Mona leaves the apartment that Thanksgiving Day is because of a spat she had with her husband, Phil. And this was before the blind incident. Their long marriage seems to be good, but it's not untested. There is a moment where Phil says, "I just want you to be happy." And Mona, quote, "did not understand how Phil could fail to understand the cruelty in such a remark, how slippery and manipulative it was. Phil did not want her to be happy. Phil wanted a happy wife." Talk to me about this idea.
Oh, Mona, I think, was being really bitchy at that moment. You know, I think that I love Mona. I absolutely love her, but she could have a bitchy side. And I think that Phil was really trying his best at that moment, but he just couldn't quite get it right. You know, he did just want a happy wife in the sense that he didn't want to have to deal with his wife's complicated, nonstop emotional drama. And I think Phil really loved Mona, or Phil really loves Mona. I don't know if you should speak about it in the present or the past tense. But I think that sometimes Mona was a lot, a handful, I think, and she has a lot of emotions, and they're big emotions, and she feels them when she feels them. And I think at that moment, he wouldn't mind just having her say, "I'm so happy, it really isn't that big a deal." But on the other hand, I don't think Mona felt heard. I think Mona felt like, you know, he just wishes he could flip a switch and she'd be happy. And he wasn't acknowledging what was upsetting her so much. I think that these are very common marital dynamics, at least in the, if I can speak about my own marital experience, which is one marriage, but that's where it all comes from. And I think everyone who's married has had those moments.
Mona is also dealing with aging, and while we really don't see a real physical decline, she's obsessed with the diminishing beauty. It had been a source of pride for her in the past, and she fondly remembers a flirtatious encounter with Bill Clinton. Can you give us some insight into Mona's relationship with the aging process and what she's facing in her own mind about aging?
I don't think Mona's excited about the physical decline that's inherent in aging and the diminution of feminine beauty. I think you're exactly right in saying that she did enjoy and take pleasure in the beauty that she had. And she is intensely aware that as time passes, that will diminish. I think it's particularly relevant, though, in her case, that as an actress playing Shakespearean roles, Shakespeare wrote a lot of great women, female leads, just up until the age of Cleopatra, who's roughly Mona's age. You know, you can play Cleopatra in your mid-50s like Judi Dench do it, but that's your upper limit for that role if you're going to play it in age-appropriate casting. There really isn't that much more for her. There's a couple of other late older roles. They're smaller parts, but they're not, they're not quite have the meat on them that a Cleopatra does, or a Rosalind did, or a Juliet does for a teenage actress, or a Lady Macbeth does for an actress in her 30s. I think she felt like it's really provoking a crisis in her life, because as she ages, her work as a Shakespearean actress is tapering down. It isn't coming to an end, but it's definitely tapering down. And this is something she has to deal with professionally and personally. I mean, I think that a huge part of her identity was as a beautiful woman, a beautiful young woman, and now she doesn't consider herself that way, although I think others still do.
I want to talk about craft for a moment, because you wrote seamless shifts between the past and present. Did you find it challenging weaving these two timelines through Mona's conscious and memory?
Oh, yeah, I found everything involving writing a book incredibly hard. I mean, if it feels seamless now, it didn't in the first 75 or 100 drafts. I mean, everything is difficult about it. You can go one way. You can sink too much in memory and there's not enough present action. You can find yourself the other way that she doesn't have what you really are. I mean, I was so excited about knowing her as a whole person. And if you want to know her as a whole person, I wanted to know where did she... I kept just thinking to my... making discoveries about her, which is the actor's term. I really loved that. But these discoveries would take me all sorts of places in her life and in her past. And then I'd want to run back to the reader and say, look what I just figured out. I got it. I got it who Mona's dad is. Or I got it. I know exactly what's happening with Mona and her sister and her brother-in-law and why Mona blames her brother-in-law for her sister's death or whatever it is. But then you put too much of that stuff and it becomes backstory heavy. And it gets to be a little bit of a bore. You kind of want to balance it one way or the other. And that's just a matter of shaving here, taking out a little bit there, refining, going back over it, looking at it one more time, reading it out loud. Exactly the process I think that, you know, you say what if, and then you what if the what if, which is a line from the book where I talk about Milton doing rehearsals. But they're just endless rehearsals. You know, you what if the what if, and then you turn it around and you try it again and you see what works.
Talk to me about point of view and perspective. How did you decide the voice and knowledge of the narrator? Because at times we even knew what the dog was thinking.
I had written two novels in the first person singular in which I took the position of being Misha Berlinski recounting a story. And I would often drift out into the third person where it was necessary. In this novel, I definitely didn't want to do that. I felt I had gone to that well too many times and there wasn't anything there. I knew I wanted to be in the third person because it seemed like you know, after you write enough in the first person, the third person is just a lot of fun. You can go anywhere you want. As far as the perspective, it sticks pretty close to Mona's perspective. I allowed it to drift around from place to place. There were a couple of places where I felt like I included stuff because it was fun. Like when I went into the dog's brain, or you remember the scene walking next to the park, there's the vegan Tamil taco vendor. And I got into his mind for, I don't know why, but I just, I guess it violates a little, some sense of the artistic unity of the novel. If you, those little drifts away from Mona's strict consciousness, but yeah, if you don't do it too often, maybe you can get away with it. And plus Mona's a handful, spending quite so much time in her brain. I think by the end of the book, most readers have, they wouldn't mind a second book about Mona, I hope, but I don't have one planned. I've just meant, but they're ready for a break now. So I thought that those gave a little bit of a different sense of what other human beings' lives might be like as people were going through the book, or dogs' lives were like.
That might tie into this next question. Talk to me about the division of the book, the structure. The story was set up in five acts and an interlude, if I remember right.
Almost every scene I imagined as being in a play. I really wanted to have a lot of dialogue, things happening. I imagined a set. It wasn't a conscious thing. I don't have it mapped out how it worked, but I really was thinking of a lot of that. You could kind of do every scene. Act one is in the same place as act five, which is Mona's apartment. The interlude is in Milton's little study upstairs. Then there's an act three where she's walking around New York. You could do that, I think, on a stage. Then act four would be in the other set, the other apartment that's featured in the novel. I kind of imagined each little scene being a little play. And I imagined a couple of moments really in my mind would be very comic on stage. And I don't know if readers will pick up on that or feel the same way, but that's really where it came from. It was just a little game I was playing with myself, thinking about it. Could it be at play?
Do you have a favorite work of Shakespeare?
You know, when I started this, it was definitely Antony and Cleopatra. I just love Antony and Cleopatra. It's such a lush play, and it's so romantic, and it shows the whole world. And it's so filled with passion and drama and just wonderful, wonderful poetry. As I went on, The Winter's Tale, I really came to love The Winter's Tale. And sensitive readers will notice that the ending goes quite a bit to The Winter's Tale. And I love The Winter's Tale also. I love all the late romances. I love the histories. I'm just crazy about the histories, especially Richard II, which I think just has the most wonderful poetry, and it's such a sad, melancholy play. I always think that the wrong plays are taught in school. We live in a world that's nothing but Hamlet, Macbeth, Othello, and Lear. And those are very hard plays to convince people to love Shakespeare with, especially Lear or slightly lesser extent, I think Hamlet. They're just difficult and not clear what's going on in those plays. I love Henry IV, Part One. There's just nonstop great characters in Henry IV, Part One, Falstaff, Hotspur. They're great plays. They're just, they deserve their reputation, but it takes a while to feel it rather than just mouth that feeling.
I really liked, was it when Mona was visiting Milton and he was even giving her advice on how to play Cleopatra?
Don't lose hope. It's a kind of a standard piece of acting advice, but they repeat it over and over again. You know, you don't know, just because it's a famous tragedy, she still has hope right up until the end. You know, I don't know how well you know Antony and Cleopatra.
Not at all.
Well, it's a great play, but Antony kills himself in Act 4 and she kills herself in Act 5. And, you know, it's an amazing thing because she has to overcome so many obstacles to kill herself. And, you know, you're kind of rooting for her to be able to do it because, you know, Caesar doesn't want her to kill herself. He wants to take her back in triumph to Rome. And so all of a sudden this play, which has been a romance for four acts, becomes this adventure story of can she outwit all of the Romans and kill herself? But she wants to kill herself largely because she still has this hope. Husband, I come, that she'll be reunited with Antony. And we don't know if she is or not in the world of the play. Right up until the end, she has to have that hope. If you go into that act five and you kind of are like convinced that she's desperate and unhappy and miserable, and then she kills herself, it's a long slog. But if she goes towards that suicide, overcoming all these obstacles to do it, It's different than others. It's not tragic. She's victorious, which is why she's such a great character. And she's different than any other Shakespeare character, because the other ones kill themselves and you think, I mean, Othello kills himself and you're like, yeah, that was a wasted life. That was just terrible. I mean, Hamlet kills himself and you're like, what are you going to do now? You couldn't have lived. But Cleopatra, you're like, you go, girl, get the asp, go for it. It's just an unbelievable dramatic twist that he puts on that act five to get you to root for her to kill herself and feel great when she does.
I don't want to leave without touching on the Me Too movement. Mona and her niece, Rachel, they're of different generations. They're not that far apart, but they did swim in different waters as far as, you know, ideas regarding the Me Too movement is concerned. Can you talk a little bit about this and perhaps why Mona defends Milton?
When I started the novel, the Me Too movement hadn't begun. And Milton was unequivocally a positive character. And then the Me Too movement started. And a lot of men like Milton were being Me Too'd, were being denounced, were losing their lives and their careers. And I thought that added a lot of dramatic tension if Mona had this issue with Milton. I also felt that this was a movement which was driven much more by younger point of view, not by younger women, but by a younger point of view. And I've talked to a lot of women who said that, you know, the behavior of these older men was allowed at the time. The norms and standards changed. And when norms and standards change, it's not necessarily fair to punish the older men for crimes that weren't crimes when they committed them. And then you talk to younger women and they'd say, but we don't want to live in the world that these men created, and we don't want to be punished ourselves for being women in a workplace, for being attractive. It was two different worldviews that I found. I thought that the novel was a good place to show two different worldviews colliding. It's very hard to convince somebody else of a different worldview. You can convince somebody else of a different point of view or a position or an argument, but to convey a worldview, you need something like a novel where people... I don't think Mona, by the end of it, was trying to convince Rachel that she was right, but I think that the novel expressed how she saw Milton and his conduct, but it also was trying to show how Rachel saw Milton and his conduct. And it was a fault line that I saw running through society. Not just society, male, female, but within female society, it was a fault line that I saw.
Well, the book is Mona Acts Out. Misha Berlinski, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was altogether my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That was Misha Berlinski, author of the book Mona Acts Out, which was published by LiveRight. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.